We'd like to thank Nestu, who's agreed to give us a seminar on anionic information theory and its connection to quantum foundations. Nestu is finishing his PhD now at Oxford in Vladkovich-Rahl's group. Go ahead, share your screen.
Yeah, thank you very much for the invitation. And let me just share the slides. Let me see. Where do we have this? One second. Share screen.
We can see your screen, if not full screen at this point, but yeah.
Yeah, let me now.
Perfect.
Does it work? Yeah, perfect. Okay. Thank you very much for the invitation to give this seminar. I know it's a Friday afternoon, so I'll try to keep it on point. I'll try to give an exhaustive review of some results that I've been working on lately. Unfortunately, they are not published, not even in preprint form, on the archive. Hopefully soon we'll be able to send them in more or less than a month. Hopefully there are some details that have to be taken care of. So yeah, my name is Nesa Tutiba Vidal. As Ellie presented me, I'm the last year in my DPhil in atomic and laser physics under Vladkovich-Rahl. And the work I'll be presenting is on anionic quantum information and mainly the relations with quantum foundations. So these works, really, mainly they have been developed by me and with the help of my collaborator, which is also a member of Vladko's group, which is Lucía Vilches Esteves. So first of all, I would like to give some motivation on why you should care about anionic quantum information and why it's even a problem for people of quantum foundations to touch on anions, which are a system mainly used in condensed matter physics. So I would like to just give the explanation, like the story of how I ended up working on anions. So first of all, I started with the perspective of wanting to study fermionic information theory, so having the fermionic information perspective, but from a very foundational perspective, because I thought that if fermions are the constituent basis of the theories that we have about reality, we should, as people in foundations, focus on understanding the perspective of reality being modeled by fermions. So we should study fermions. And then in fermionic information theory, we see that there's a clash between the no signaling principle and the principle of local tomography. So this was seen by Ariano and collaborators first, where due to the no signaling principle, in fermions you have to impose superselection rules, and once these superselection rules are imposed, the principle of local tomography fails. So I was very interested in studying this relationship. Another input that brought me to anions was to understand and the theory developed by Deutsch and my supervisor, Chiara Marletto, of using constructor theory. And I would like to use it to some sort of reactivate the reconstruction program of quantum theory from a different perspective for a more information theory, because I would like to use the concepts of constructor theory, where a concrete definition of what an information theory is, to classify all possible information theories. Then I thought that I should explore all the known information theories to have some insight on which structures should emerge from this more abstract and general approach of constructor theory. In this task of studying constructor theory in the context of different information theories, I saw that system composition was essential. It was a point where we should really focus on thinking exactly how to model system composition and not prevent us from not being too restrictive in the choices that we make on how to model systems that, in the many ways that you can compose systems. So another result that provided some input was that you can have local Onticore generalized states for quantum mechanics. This is a result by Raymond Robichaud and Deutsch and Haydn in the 2000s. It has been combined recently. There's other authors that hint at the same in the same direction, where you can have a local realistic interpretation of quantum theory if you change the ontology that we are used working and you expand it to also include observables. So what my question was that since we do not have the principle of local tomography, can we have this construction developed by Deutsch and Raymond Robichaud also hold for constrained systems? Does the superselection rules or the constraints in the system impede in some way to have this local construction? And I studied that in the beginning of my PhD, and I did it for fermions. And I saw that the constraints and the superselection rule impede you from doing the usual choice of choosing observables as your local ontic states. However, you can choose the creation operators, which are in some sense non-physical, but you could promote them onto the ontology, and then you can still have local ontic states for fermionic systems. So all of these questions then pushed me to...
Just a question. So when you say, I remember that you mentioned something to me before that, when you say local fermionic states here, it's not local, local ontic states, it's not local in the sense of Bell local?
No, it's not.
What is
no.
it? Okay.
No, it's local in the sense of being system local, that you can have to each subsystem an associated mathematical object that fully represents the all the properties of the state. And that object, in the case of fermions, it's the creation operator.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that makes sense. Yes, also I forgot to say, if there's any question, Norris, if there's any question during the talk, feel free to interrupt me because I don't want to lose anybody, and it's better to address small points as they come rather than to address them in the end, if that's fine for you.
Let me ask a quick one then.
Perfect.
Is this notion of local ontic states in terms of creation operators going to also be possible for a bosonic system, or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So in a way, I guess what I'm wondering is that your story about local tomography and Hayden Deutsch is sort of that's the bosonic case, which is sort of straightforward, and the fermionic case is the one that.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yes. However, what I have to say is that the difference between the fermionic and the bosonic case is that in the bosonic case, you can recover the creation operators by linear combination of observables. So having the creation operator is kind of like you can express in terms of the creation operator, but you could say that with local observables, it's enough as well. However, in the fermionic case, you cannot recover creation operators only from local observables because of the superselection rule. So, like, restricts you your local observables in a very severe way. Like, this is the distinction.
Okay, thanks.
No worries. So then, why I was basically pushed into onions? Because I was aware I wanted to explore the different possibilities of indistinguishable particle systems that we have, and our friends in condensed matter physics, they have provided with this exotic theory described as everybody, because there's no tensor product structure, or it's not based in terms of creation operators. So this became a challenge for this notion of local ontic states, because the natural progression was to express the local ontic states as the creation operators. But now I have a theory that a priori is not constructed in terms of creation operators. So this host a challenge that they wanted to support. Also, we should focus on onions because even though it's a theory that it only works in 2+1 dimensions, it's still a fundamental theory of nature, and theoretical physicists use it. And I think that our role as people in foundations is to provide insight and extend on all the models that we have to theories of physics. Also, in the particular case of quantum foundations, since there are very strong links with the field of quantum information, the fact that non-abelian onions are proposed to be used for topological computation, it also adds to be an incentive of why people in foundations should care to understand the local properties and the information properties of anionic systems, basically to guide all of these investigations. Another good reason I feel to study anions is that they are a constrained quantum system. And I think mainly the role of quantum foundations is to provide some insight to the efforts of quantizing gravity. And I think that everybody expects that when gravity is quantized successfully, there are several models, but all the models hint that there will be a constrained quantum system. So I feel that from the foundation's perspective, in order to ease some conceptual difficulties that people in these communities and also in our community we have about quantum gravity, focusing on a model that works that people in condensed matter use kind of regularly to describe reality, where you have supposedly constrained, you have a constrained system with supposedly strange properties, such as not having a tensor product or not having creation operators. I think it's very interesting from that perspective as well. And also, for me personally, the connections in foundations, lately we have been using the diagrammatic approach proposed by Bob Kuka and his collaborators. And anions, they are not described in terms of tensor products, they are not described in terms of creation operators, but they are described diagrammatically. However, they are not a process theory per se, because they are not a symmetric monoidal category in the sense that the symmetric part, the part where you need a single swap operation, it's not satisfied. This will become clearer, and you can ask more questions regarding this now I will present the theory itself. So for this talk, I have mainly two objectives. You will see that there's basically a strong division within the talk. The first one is to understand the notion of locality in anions and how to do so without having a tensor product structure, and to try to see if we can recover a notion of creation operators. The objective number two is to study the information properties and the structures that we need to analyze in anionic quantum information. So without further ado, let's go with objective number one, and let me present this theory of anions that I have been talking about. Anions are a theory in condensed matter, which is a type of, they are a family of theories, to be honest, of particles that live in a two-dimensional space, and then they can evolve in time. So they are a generalization of the spin statistics theorem, where when restricted to only two or one dimensions, you have more options than bosons and fermions. So the elements, the basic elements of the theory are the following. So anions are described by particle types, an anion theory. It's given by some particle types that that can exist within that theory. For simplicity, I will be focusing on a single anion theory, which is called Fibonacci theory, which is the minimal anion theory that to exemplify all the points, I think it's relevant and it's simpler. We could use Majorana fermions that they are proposed to be more physical in the sense like to realize them in the laboratory. But I think that would add some redundancy to the points of, from the foundation's perspective, that we don't want. So I will be sticking with Fibonacci anions. So for Fibonacci anions, the particle types, which are labeled by A, can take two values. Either you can have the vacuum, or you can have the particle type tau. Okay, you have to imagine this as literally the vacuum. It means that you do not have a particle in that point of your two-dimensional space, and a particle tau is you have that type of particle. Then to specify the anion theory, what you need to specify is the fusion rules. The fusion rules are the way these particle types, you can also think of them as charges if you want, on how they then combine. So if you think in terms of charges, it's if I have a charge A here in the left and I have a charge B here in the right, what is the total charge of my system? How can these charges recombine? And if you want to think more physically, what you can think of is if I have a charge here and a hard charge here, if I bring them together, or if I look from very far away, collectively, how do they behave? What is the total charge of the system? Okay. What makes Fibonacci anions very interesting is this property here. I don't know if you can see my cursor, hopefully. Yeah, perfect.
Yeah, I see your cursor.
Yes.
Perfect. What makes them very interesting and all the weird properties will emerge is from this simple property that if I have two tau particles, they can fuse to either annihilate each other, so the total charge can be the identity, or the total charge can be the same tau particle. Okay, this equation has to be read as the times. It's basically saying the left fuses with the right, and the plus you have to interpret it as an or, basically. Then in any anion theory, you have the identity charge, which basically acts as an identity for fusion. So any particle type fused with the identity, just that part. Okay. So now let me go a bit.
Just a question, sorry.
Yeah, sure.
So tau times tau, what does that mean physically? Is it two particles on adjacent sides, or are they at the same point in some sense? What should I?
Yeah, you have to interpret as you have two particles in two different sides, but collectively, what can the total charge can be?
Okay.
So you can think of them like if I bring them together, you literally fuse them into a different quasi particle. And okay. The thing is, like, you have two different possible outcomes, basically. Okay. So from these properties, what you can do is establish the states, or let's say the cats of your theory, which is to specify completely the physical situation. You not only need to tell me which charges I have in my manifold, you also need to tell me on how do they fuse together in a chain of total charges. So we can see here that, for example, our state psi of N anions, in order to be completely determined, you need to do this fusion tree where you specify how these charges are combined in terms of all the total charges need to be specified in order to completely determine the state of the system. Okay.
Another quick one. Question. Sorry. I'm just curious. Am I right to imagine that this works analogously to, you know, representation theory of angular momentum? That, you know,
yeah, when I... exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so I can think what the plus, what you call the disjunction, I could also think of that as direct sum of...
Exactly, yeah. So you could think, for example, yeah, you could think of them as spin recombinations as well, for example. And yeah, and this is a very good mental image to be thinking of. Exactly. So in...
Does that mean I can think of different particle types as labeled by irreducible representations of the symmetric group? Or is it more complicated than that?
I think it's a bit more complicated in general than that. But I don't want to say no, because I don't know enough about representation theory to say outright no. Okay. Maybe yes, but I don't know.
Thanks.
No worries. Yes. So, once you have these states of your theory, right, where you need to exactly determine like this, all the combinations of, let's say, the charges of your theory, you could think analogously with the comment that Rob made on what happens if I choose a different recombination basis. What happens if instead of combining the nth anion with the nth minus one anion, and then combining that total spin or that total charge with the nth minus two anion, et cetera, et cetera. So like in this sort of diagram, what happens if I choose a different diagram? So part of the anion theory is to tell how to do these basis transformations. These are called F matrices. We will not be using them, but I thought that for some concepts of how to combine systems, this way of choosing different bases, different possible ways of, to recombine, it's quite relevant for the foundation's perspective. But here, basically, they are, if I have a state in this recombination basis, I can write it in the other recombination basis unitarily, and this is fixed by the anion theory. This transformation is fixed. Another transformation that is fixed by the anion theory is the physical operation of swapping two particles. So the main difference between anions or with fermions and bosons is that the swapping has a direction. So since we are now in two dimensions and not in three dimensions, the word anion comes from the fact that you can swap two particles and basically you can get any phase. So it's not the phase plus or minus one, as in for the fermions and the bosons. So here, if you swap two particles in this way, with A going in front of B, so we are doing a bit like this, we will get a phase. And this is any, it's not any complex phase, it's a phase fixed by the anion theory. It's fixed by the anion theory, but it does not take values as plus or minus one, not always. So in the case of Fibonacci anions, I think it gets the, it's the phase of three pi over fifth. Over five, for example. So that then what it makes is that if you swap the particles clockwise or anticlockwise, you will get a different phase. So then it will be meaningful. It's a meaningful difference. Yeah, sure.
Could you explain how to make sense of this clockwise versus counterclockwise swap, given that you are in 2D? Like the picture makes it look like I sort of need the third dimension to talk about them. But are you sort of imagining they lie on a line and the two?
No. So like they lie on a plane, right?
Okay. Yeah.
And if, for example, if you see this ninth particle, right, I mm-hmm. could bring it over here without moving on the third dimension. And this eighth one, like I could bring them here. Does it make sense what I'm trying to show or not?
So is it sort of whether the red particle passes on the left or on the right of the blue particle as they swoop?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. And then these diagrams are just an abstract representation of that distinction. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the way, yeah, maybe I forgot to say this, the way you can, at least the way I interpret these diagrams is that you have, they are planar diagrams, but you can think of them as A and B. They lie on this two-dimensional surface, and then you have time as your third dimension, so going up, right? Mm. And so when I exchange these two particles like this, if I project it in time, then I have like this helix, which I project into a plane, and then you get this.
Okay, this Yeah, that's the part of it. Thank you. Okay.
Perfect. No worries. Yeah. So okay. So these are the basic ingredients of any onion theory, and yeah, what a meaningful point is that this phase will depend on the total charge that you have. So it does not only depend on which particle types you are swapping. It also depends on which is the total charge of these particles. Okay. So now let me just give you a more concrete case, because we will be using it later, of how to understand anions as constrained systems. So I will focus on the case of we only have like two anions, and they will be like two Fibonacci anions. So all the kets, all the states of the theory can be expressed in these bases. This is a complete orthonormal basis of the two Fibonacci anion system. Okay, which basically consists on all the allowed fusion rules that you can do. So what is meaningful is that basically, if I have this state where I have two tau particles that fuse to the identity, and I have this state of two tau particles that fuse to tau, they are orthogonal. So they are completely distinct states, even though you have the same type of particle in your manifold. Okay. So you see that you have five states. However, you can think of them if you want it, because as embedded in a three qubit system, because you could say, oh, but really, like in this diagram, what I really have is like on the left, I can have either E or tau, so that's like a qubit. On the right, I can have E or tau, so that's like a qubit, and the total charge can also be E or tau, so that's also like a qubit. So I could think of this as a three qubit system if I want. However, you will have to constrain it to not allow the terms that are not allowed by the fusion rules. The constraint operator would be this one if you express it in the canonical basis. And however, anions do have a super selection rule written in itself. The super selection rule is basically the conservation of total charge. The super selection rule they consider is that the total charge, like all the transformations you can do, must preserve the total charge of your system. So then, like if you express it in a matrix representation on the canonical basis, you will have that any density operator rho that is allowed in this anion, this Fibonacci system, will have to look like this. It has to be block diagonal. Okay. This structure really tells you that you do not have a tensor product structure between the left and the right anions, because the left and the right anions both can be either in the identity or tau. However, you still have five states. So you cannot, like mathematically, you could decompose the system as a tensor structure, but a tensor product structure, but it would not be the meaningful tensor product structure of having the system of the left times the system of on the right. So now the question is, without having this structure, how do we need to measure correlations between the left and the right anion particles? Because we intuitively we have a notion of separation between these, like within these systems. We know that we should be able to separate the anion on the left and the anion on the right, and study the quantification of the correlations between these two objects. The question is how to do it. So let me. On this intuitive notion of anion subsystems, we exactly do a bit this, in the sense of we have our two-space manifold and we break it into sub-manifolds, basically. We slice it in different ways, okay? Which you can consider as modes, if you want, or excitation modes where the anion can lie, right? However, now what we observe, one first property is that when we pick our notion of subsystem, what we are actually doing, what we have to choose, is a preferred basis, or a preferred basis, or a notion of local operators. So, for example, here we have here on the left we have four anions. So we have like four. We have four anions because we have broken the total two-dimensional manifold in four subregions. But of these four subregions, we want to make a bipartition. So we want to choose only one subregion and the other subregion. So imagine that you want to do the bipartition, that you want to study correlations between anion 1 and 4 with anion 2 and 3, right? The way you find this natural basis is you merge these 2 and 3 because you want them to be together. You merge this 1 and 4 over this way, right? But now you have to merge the combination of the one and four with the total charge of two and three, and then you do so, and then you have to project to have the planar diagram. However, you will have a choice to, when you join this one and four, if you do it behind, let's say, the two and three, or if you do it in front of the two and three. I hope this it's more or less clear. Here. So the way you break, the way you choose your system decomposition, it's relative in the sense of you have many choices to express which are the subsystems of your theory. It's not enough to say which regions you have broken your full region, you also need to say how do you glue them and what is their relative gluing. I hope this makes sense. Here I just have a different example where it's more straightforward because you just merge 3 and 4, you merge 1 and 2, and then you merge them together, but everything just collapses very nicely when you project everything towards the left in this planar diagram. I don't know if I explained this very well. So if you have some question, please don't hesitate to ask. So, however, now that we have a preferred basis where we have said, we have specified the gluing of the subregions, now we have a notion of local observable and local unitaries. This notion can be expressed in this diagrammatic form. This is part of the anion theory. This is not a problem. And what we were able to prove with my collaborator is that under this notion and applying the partial trace inherited from superselection rules, you have the no signal in principle satisfied. So that if you have a global state and you just apply a local unitary, and then you partial trace over the region where you have applied the local unitary, the state would be the same as the partial trace over that region without having applied the local unitary. So we have the no signaling principle satisfied, and we have the notion of local unitaries and observables. So following the work of Bella, if you have the notion of local observables and local unitaries, you can have a notion of subsystem, and you can study entanglement and correlations. So, but going back to the foundations, our question was, okay, so now that we have the no signaling principle satisfied, we know by the result of Raymond-Robichaud that this implies that that you should have these local ontic states. And this guided us and also our work on fermions. This guided us on saying, okay, if for fermions and bosons, the local ontic states end up reducing to just being the creation or the annihilation operators, why for anions can we not use that that intuition or that known result to deduce which how the annihilation operators in anionic systems should look like? And this is exactly what we did, and this is how we found annihilation operators for anions. I could go a bit on detail on the construction, but I don't know if I have enough time or if it's of interest. But basically, we imposed that we wanted some operator such that was preserved under local unitaries of the other local on their complement. We knew that they were not going to be observables because general creation operators or annihilation operators are not observables, at least what we know for from bosons and fermions. And then we looked within this set of preserved operations terms that would annihilate tau, let's say. So what we call by annihilate is that, for example, here, you have to imagine this as being your bra, because this is our ket. So basically, we have just transposed, and by transposed, we just flipped. We have flipped the ket, where we transform our tau here on our bra to just the identity. So exactly what an annihilation term would look like. And then what we demanded was that we would take linear combinations of these annihilating terms. And what we demanded was that the resulting set of operators together with their dagger should generate the local algebra of observables. And so tau A zero, tau A zero dagger, tau A one and tau A one dagger, they generate the local algebra of observables of the anion in the left, let's say, that we had the notion before. And also we demanded that all the annihilation and creation operators of the whole system generate the total algebra of observables. And this is satisfied by these operators, and this is unique in the sense of also adding some restriction that if you swap the annihilation operators of the left with the if you perform a swap between the left and the right, the annihilation operators on the right are the swap applied to the annihilation operators on the left. That is how we get these factors that come from swapping between the left and the right. And what is interesting about this finding is that what we need in order for, even though Fibonacci has a single particle that is non-trivial, so a single particle that can be annihilated, you still require two annihilation operators. So for a single particle, since you have two different fusion channels that are kind of orthogonal to each other, you require two annihilation operators for a single particle. And this is what distinguishes the weird properties of non-abelian anions, where you would always require more than one annihilation operator for a particle type, to abelian anions, where with a single annihilation operator, you would be able to recover the abelian case. I want to say that these annihilation operators, when applied to a different anion family, for example, you could model fermions as an anion family, this notion of annihilation operators will recover exactly the annihilation operators that we have for fermions. So this is very good insight that we are on the right track. So now, of course,
question.
Sure. Sorry.
When you recover fermions, you're not going to have two annihilation operators associated with a given fermion mode. So
no, exactly.
So how does that, how do you go from two operators to one in that limit?
Yeah. So here you need these two terms. Let me just come here. So first of all, we recover the minus one sign because this R E tau tau E tau tau. Yeah. For fermions is exactly the minus sign. So it's what you would get in the, how it's called, in the fermionic operators. Mm-hmm. However, the second term you get here by having this different fusion channel that you would directly not get because it would not be allowed for fermions. So this term, like, it would become completely redundant because when you do the construction of finding which is the minimal linear combination of annihilating terms such that recovers you the local algebra of observables, you would see that you only require a single term, which is, let's say, for the fermionic case would be this term and this term with a minus sign here.
Okay.
I hope it makes sense. Yep. I don't know if I explained it very well, but okay.
Thanks.
Okay. So now, of course, I've been talking a lot about this, that our inspiration came from this result by Raymond Robichaud and these local ontic states. Now that, of course, we have found the creation operators, now we are able to claim that we can use these creation operators as local elements of reality in the exact sense that, in the exact same way as we could do so for the fermionic case, for the bosonic case, and for the qubit case. So basically what the Deutsch-Haydn interpretation does is just the reinterpretation of what the Heisenberg picture is. So Heisenberg picture is basically that you leave the initial state fixed and you evolve the observable, not the observables, but the operators on, in your theory. So the idea basically is that if you consider your the generators of your algebra of observables to be physical entities, if you know the time evolution of the generators of your local algebra of observables, that is enough to know all the expectation values of any observable in your theory for the time evolved state. So, and the plus sign is that we know that the creation, that the generators of the algebra of observables, they break locally. That knowing the collection of the generators of the local algebra of observables, it's enough to know any global observable. So in this sense, we can have local realism in quantum theory. But you have to pay a strong price. The first price is, of course, to consider it's to consider operators as being ontic in the sense of as being part of the reality. But that, from the field perspective, is not that weird, because if you think in terms of quantum field theory, if you think that all the assumption you have to do is that quantum field is real, because quantum fields in the end are the observables of your theory, it's not such a leap to say, okay, you have to, instead of considering that psi is ontic, for people who feel that psi is ontic, on top of that, I only need to believe that the field is real, which is what you would do in classical mechanics anyway. But now that field is quantum, okay, it has this decomposition operators, but so that's not a big leap. What is the big leap is that what you can see is that if you accept this position, this violates the Leibniz principle. The Leibniz principle, in a sense, as Rob has a very nice paper on this, the Leibniz principle, as in that you would have two physical situations that they provide you exactly the same empirist, it would provide the same predictions, they would get all the statistics would be the same. However, you would be describing, you would be saying that they are different ontologically, that you would be describing them as different situations, just because the evolution of the unobservable parts of your operators would be different. I hope that makes sense.
Can I ask a couple questions?
Of course.
So before you started talking about Leibniz,
yeah,
it sounded to me like you were saying that these observables, I can write down any observable in terms of these local algebras.
Yes.
Maybe I misunderstood, but wouldn't that only be true if local tomography held? And does local tomography hold for any of?
That's a very good point. That's a very nice distinction that I forgot to make. Local tomography would mean that you could decompose any global observable in terms of local observables. This would be local tomography. What I'm saying here, it's a bit stronger or a bit weaker in some sense. That here, what I'm saying is that you can decompose any local any global observable in terms of these local operators. These local operators do not need to be necessarily observables in themselves.
Oh, I see.
So in the fermionic case, or even in the anion case, these local operators would be creation or annihilation operators, but creation and annihilation operators are not observables in these super selected systems. Therefore, that's why you don't have local tomography, precisely because of this. I hope this distinction was, I have to
let, be clear now. Let me try to give a version of that idea as I understand it. So the typical example of a failure of local tomography that people in quantum foundations talk about is if you consider quantum theory over the real field rather than over the complex field.
Yes.
And so if you say, right, the Y poly is no longer an observable,
mm-hmm.
Then nonetheless, you know, they're in entangled states over two qubits, which if I decompose in terms of the basis of poly operators, they have a Y tensor Y term.
Yep.
Because that has no, you know,
the I's cancel out. Yeah,
the I's cancel out. Thank you. Yeah, and because the Y's are not considered observables, you'd say okay, that local tomography fails. So if in the context of real quantum theory, I were to say the poly Y is not an observable, but it is a kind of local beable. It exists. It's like your creation operator. It feels like you could sort of say something similar. I mean, I haven't thought it through, but it feels like that would be a parallel move. Have I got that right?
Yeah. That's, I would consider that a parallel move. Maybe I'm missing something, but a priori, I would consider that a parallel move, yeah.
Okay, my second question was just,
sure.
I didn't quite understand what were the two situations that were ontologically distinct, but empirically indiscernible. Did you try to describe those two situations? Or are you just telling us, trust me, there are pairs of such situations?
I'm telling you, trust me, there are these two situations, but I can provide an example for you if you want. So basically, think of, we have the initial state phi zero. So if I evolve, and I start with my canonical creation operators, they are pristine, and consider the two following facts. Either I apply the identity as a unitary evolution, so I do nothing, basically, or I apply a unitary, which leaves phi zero invariant, but other terms, other orthogonal states to phi zero do not, are not invariant.
Okay.
So my unitary evolution is the identity. It's not the identity. Then, since I would be applying a non-identity operation to my creation operators would evolve non-trivially,
mm-hmm.
right?
Okay.
Since my ontology is just a collection of the time evolution of my creation operators,
mm-hmm.
I would have that these two, I would consider these two ontologically distinct, just because the creation operators have taken take different values.
But it seems to me that if instead of considering only phi naught, you sort of considered a tomographically complete set of possible states. You would be able to see the difference between identity and this non-trivial unitary.
Yes, that is a very good point.
And that's usually like the whole empirical indiscernibility really should be with respect to a whole battery of such tests.
Yes, this is, there's some critiques. So this is the critique I presented was by Wallace and Timson to the original Deutsch paper. So even without going to super selected systems, there was debate this for qubits, where you could just consider observables as being these local elements of reality. And this was one of the rebuttals, that it's true that in a single shot, you are not able to discern between these two physical situations. However, if you allow me to change the initial state of the system, then you could do process tomography, and then you could see these as two distinct systems. But now, then the question is, like, are you allowed to do process tomography or not? That is the question, because what Wallace and Tinson would say, I feel, is that you are not allowed to do so, because this is a characteristic of the state that you have right now, with the initial conditions that you have right now. And the physical situation that you have to consider are given by the initial state that you have, not of the process of what would have happened, like this counterfactual property of what would have happened if your system would have been initialized with a different initial state. These are the
positions. It feels like, my intuition, if I'm understanding correctly, is that you kind of have to allow for tomography. So let me just try to explain why in terms of a simple example. Like, suppose somebody was trying to argue, so forget about anyons, let's just consider a theory of two qubits. Oh. If somebody tried to persuade me that there's no way of distinguishing identity on those two qubits from swapping the two qubits, that they're sort of like empirically indiscernible, and they said, well, here's my proof. If I take a singlet and I apply identity, or I apply swap, all the measurements I see have exactly the same statistics. That's my proof. Now, I would say, well, that's a terrible proof, because the you can distinguish identity from swap, you just can't do it on the singlet. You know, there's other states, however, that will allow me to do it. Like if I take the up tensor down state, you know, that will perfectly distinguish identity from swap. And so it just feels very foreign to me to try to restrict people's ability to vary that state when trying to assess differences between other circuit components.
I completely agree with that sentiment. However, maybe I mischaracterized the position of Wallace and Timson. So the question
rather than going into the Wallace Timson reply, I was just challenging your claim that this is indeed a violation of Leibniz's principle in your theory.
Okay, makes sense. The thing is, like, I happen to be closer to your position than to Wallace of Timson. So I just put this notion of violates Leibniz's principle just to be very fair on all the critiques that this interpretation has, and not to say this is a fantastic interpretation, it has zero problems, all is good. So my point is that according to some authors, this could violate Leibniz's principle. And let me just say this. So let's go to the singlet case, right? Would you say that the physical system that you have, the configuration that you have of the singlet, is any different if you apply the identity or if you apply the swap? Because Wallace and Tinson, what they say is that all the statistical properties of the singlet after applying the identity or the singlet after applying the swap, they are the same. They are empirically the same. Because for any measurement that you can do, any expectation value that you can calculate, these two situations would give you the same. This is why they consider these two physical systems to be, that they should be the same.
Okay.
Right. So that is why, like, they consider that it violates Leibniz principle. They allow for state tomography. What they don't allow is to say that the transformations prior to the state of a system is what you are allowed to do tomography on, because what they think of empirically accessible is the situation that the fixed in time state that you have. I don't know if I'm making my point very clear. Like what?
Why don't I would say continue it beyond?
Yeah, sorry.
I don't want to get too caught up on whether the Leibnizian principle holds or not, because I think you probably have a lot more to say on this.
Yeah, sorry.
No, that's okay. Maybe we can come back to it later.
Sure. Yeah, it's a very good discussion that I was hoping to have. So that's fantastic. Okay, so that finalizes my first part of the talk. I don't know if I'm doing very poorly on time, but I will try to wrap up the anionic information theory part a bit fast. I don't know, Ellie, how bad I'm doing on time. How many minutes should I?
We're pretty flexible. So we've been at this an hour. I'd say if you could try to wrap up in
not more than
15 minutes, but we're flexible on our end. So don't consider it a crisis.
Okay, perfect. Thank you very much. So now that we have found, like we have studied this notion of creation operator, we have done this interpretation in terms of a Deutsch-Haydn interpretation, we have discussed not enough with Rob, if it violates Leibniz principle or not, if it should be allowed, which type of tomography. But now I want to focus on more on quantum information aspects of anionic information theory, because this property of not having the tensor product really brings very interesting structures of in the information theory set. So the first structure that, or the first surprising result that one sees is that you have asymmetric marginals. So we can consider just the pure states in this very simple scenario of two Fibonacci anions. And usually what we would have with pure states is that we can use the von Neumann entropy to measure the entanglement in pure states. And usually we can use just the von Neumann entropy because we have a Schmidt decomposition. But Schmidt decomposition heavily relies on having a tensor product decomposition. So Schmidt decomposition allows you to say, it's a one line proof, that the spectra of the marginal row A, the spectra of the marginal row B, they have to coincide when you have a tensor product decomposition. And then you can establish a measure on this spectra of these marginals, and it would be the same for A and for B. Basically, in this case, you just use the von Neumann entropy. So these two should agree. And then we say that if the von Neumann entropy on either of the two marginals is zero, then we will have that our state is not entangled. And if it's more than zero, then we will say that it is entangled. However, here we can find this beautiful state. It's not difficult to find it. And I hope it's clear what it means. It's just one over square root of two superposition between having an anion in the left and having two anions that fuse to a global charge of an anion tau on both in the left and the right. So if you consider this state and we consider the super selected partial tracing procedure that you can do diagrammatically by just drawing loops and evaluating loops as they say you have to do in the theory, so it's self-consistent, you end up getting that the row A just consists of the state made by a single tau. That is a pure state for the one anion, one Fibonacci anion situation. That is just a pure state. You have a single tau. It's completely pure. However, if you trace out A, you get a completely mixed state, a completely mixed state. And this is very surprising the first time you see it, because now the von Neumann entropy, of course, over rho B is one and the von Neumann entropy of rho A is zero. So now what you see is that the von Neumann entropy is completely unable to characterize what the what it does not work as a measure of entanglement, because I would like you to bet, I would like to make this a bit interactive, if you would bet if this state is entangled or not. It's just a bet. It doesn't need to be informed.
I'm going to say no.
Okay. Any other contestants?
I'm going to say yes. Just okay. To go against.
That's good. Somebody else? Okay. Just in case. The answer is Rob wins. It's not. It's not entangled.
Wow.
Yes. The good news is that since we have local observables, we can define the notion of uncorrelated state. And since this is such a small system, we can just do it by hand and find all uncorrelated states. And yeah, an uncorrelated state in quantum information, usually it's defined to be a state that satisfies this equation for all local observables OA and OB, local in A and local in B, respectively. And usually it is states of this form that are pure. They are equivalent to be just product states. So when you have a tensor product, basically the states that you have are just products. However, here you have this very weird structure where you have like two types of uncorrelated states. One where basically you have superpositions of a tau anion being on the left, superposed with two tau anions combining to a global charge tau, or a tau being on the right, superposed with two taus combining to a global tau. So if you think of the geometric picture that you would have, it would be something like this, that you would have the set of all pure states. It will not be convex, but this is just a very, this is just a diagram to think of this. So we'll have the set of all our pure states, and inside of them, like, we will have our uncorrelated states. Okay. However, we see that they are like two distinct regions, and they meet at a single point. And this point is the state where basically beta is equal to one and the alphas are zero. So now the question, it comes from, okay, if now I want to find an entanglement measure of this set, of course, I could propose different things. But before doing so, I want to see the role of local operations. The role of local operations usually is very relevant to define separable states and to define like the free resources that you have, because basically they are the largest group that send uncorrelated states to uncorrelated states. However, here, it is still the case that local operations is the largest group that leaves the uncorrelated states set invariant. So if you apply any local operation to any uncorrelated state, it will transform it to an uncorrelated state. However, it does so, the set of local operations is so restricted that it's very poor, the transformations that you can do. At maximum, what you can do is induce a relative phase change between these terms. So when we look at this bubble, if you start from a state that is here, you cannot map it using local operations to another uncorrelated state that lives in the other bubble. And at most, like, really, like, the transformations that you can do are very, very poor. So now we have this very weird situation where we have, like, from the resource theory point of view, where we have uncorrelated states, which should be considered the free states, basically, in the entanglement resource theory perspective. But now, if we consider all our free operations to be just local operations, then we have like two free states that we cannot connect. Well, not only two, like, we have a lot of free states that you cannot connect through free operations. So we don't think that we should stop here. What we really should be doing is to analyze these transformations, which will not be able to be expressed in terms of unitaries. Rather, they would have to be expressed in terms of unitaries restricted to concrete inputs. So you would need to have a free transformation being a unitary, but restricted to just some initial states, because otherwise it would, if you apply this unitary to, we would have a unitary that if applied to an uncorrelated state, it would map it to the other uncorrelated state. But if inputted the same unitary with a different uncorrelated state, it would be mapped to an entangled state. So we don't want that. What is very interesting from the foundation's perspective is that this structure, it's similar, I think it's completely exactly the same to the ones that you find in alignable state transformation, alignable states in the perspective neutral quantum reference frame approach. There you have for an internal quantum reference frame, when you change references, you need to do these mappings that are unitaries restricted to the inputs that you use. So, and once you have this description of this mapping, now you can ask a lot of questions in the sense of, okay, of course we could measure the entanglement of anionic systems using the relative entropy between any state with this set of uncorrelated states, but then we would like to see operationally this entanglement, how it is expressed. So for example, we would like to see this teleportation protocol, how you can use this entanglement as a resource. And now if we have these free operations, these unitary restricted maps as free operations, now we can start to talk about how we could do the teleportation protocol, for example. Also, how to do entanglement distillation, et cetera, et cetera. So it's very crucial that we find a way and a compact way to express these transformations. Also, this asymmetry does not only happen here. The asymmetry between the marginals, it's general. So we would have this very strange systems where you would have an entangled state, completely entangled, however, with asymmetric marginals. So now the question comes from, because usually one would give like this naive thinking of why the marginal should be the same in an entangled state. It's because like all the information is in the correlation between the two, and the correlation should be evenly distributed between the two parts. So now this naive explanation on why the marginals are the same completely breaks down with this very simple system. And what I'm excited to see is that, for example, if we would have asymmetric teleportation protocols, where you would have an entangled state that it's asymmetric between A and B, and you would be able to teleport from A to B with a certain probability, your state, but from B to A, you would not be able to teleport with that same probability. The probability would be much less. This is research in progress, and I'm looking forward to study more of these concepts. So now some conclusions. I'm wrapping up, basically, so we can have a bit of discussion. Main points that the getaway of this talk was that anions provide a different perspective on subsystems and entanglement structures of constrained systems. They give you a very, you can manipulate all these concepts in a very specific framework. So now we know which structures and which behaviors we should expect in constrained systems. So this is a very good tool, for example, for when exploring different constrained systems, such as some models in quantum gravity, of what structures we should be expecting. So we are not so shocked and we have the right tools to manipulate and understand. Second, the result that we have found anionic annihilation operators and moreover that they can act as local elements of reality, even in this so-called topological theory, you can have a local description. This is a very nice result that we found. Third, that tensor product compositions are not necessary at all to define subsystems and entanglement, that just having the notion of local observable is it's sufficient. That pure anionic states have asymmetric marginal spectra. This is the result from anionic quantum information, and that the von Neumann entropy is a bad entanglement measure because the marginals are do not be inside. And finally, that local operations do not cover the uncorrelated state set, that we need is state-dependent maps or transformations, and that there's a very good connection with this notion of alignable states in the perspective neutral quantum reference frames, which there, if you want to study some entanglement slash coherent invariance, you really need to work with these maps in order to make the transformations. So it's very relevant to really understand how to deal with these state-dependent maps as free operations. Now I would like to discuss some possible future directions that I would be very thrilled to study. This is the first point is exactly this one, which is I want to understand these free operations using process theory, so also the aromatic approach. But since it's not describable by unitaries, I think maybe some complications will go ahead, but I would really like to develop these entanglement measures because I think it's very relevant to understand how to quantify entanglement in these highly constrained systems. Also to connect with alignable states in the perspective of neutral quantum reference frames and to the notion of subsystem relativity they have there. More on the foundation side, I would like to really study the relation of local ontic states with process theories, because all of these notions, they are very diagrammatic, but I would like to see how they reduce the notion of observable to process theories where you only have, where you have unitaries. And also I would like to discuss if these systems break the Leibniz principle, if they not, if they do, in which way they do. This is something I would really like to explore and discuss. Then more concretely, I would like to link process theories, which have this very nice diagrammatic language with constructor theory, because now that I have more or less studied subsystem composition, I am able to understand constructor theory from a more fundamental side. And now that I know which are the allowed compositions that you can have, I think that the link with process theory should be done. The only issue that I have is the issue of the condition of being symmetric, in the sense of that process theories are considered to be symmetric monoidal categories. And these examples, this example of anions may complicate things, but it may be overcome. I'm in contact with Bob Kuka and Alex Kissinger on this topic, so hopefully nice discussions will come from there. And once this link is done, I would like to use like all the formalism of process theories to classify all information theories. So instead of the usual reconstruction program of trying to just reconstruct quantum theory, distinguishable quantum theory, I would like to have a more fine-grained reconstruction program where from first principles, I would like to differentiate between classical information theory, fermionic information theory, anionic information theory, distinguishable quantum information theory. And I think that with these tools of linking process theory and constructor theory together, this should be possible. Finally, more on the quantum gravity side, I would like to express the Fos-Marlette-Overdrahl experiment in a diagrammatic form, because if we expect quantum gravity to be a highly constrained system. We cannot rely on arguments where the tensor products are embedded within. So I would really like to have this very general formulation of the VMV experiment that is consistent, that is very mathematically sound, and that it's very general for any theory of gravity that does not rely on tensor product structure. And that's it. That's a non-exhaustive list of bibliography of relevant papers that I cited during the talk. And yeah, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, that was great. Thank you so much. We'll do questions by raising our hands on Zoom. Rob, go ahead.
What a nice start. Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for the talk. I've got a whole bunch of questions. Let's see. So first, just a clarification. Am I to understand that people had not defined annihilation and creation operators for anions prior to your work? It sounded like you were saying that.
Yes. They didn't.
Oh, that's kind of surprising. I assumed that when people were talking about anionic statistics, they would have worked in terms of creation annihilation operators, but I guess not.
No, we assumed so as well. For 1D anions, they did. They solved it, but not for the general case of two-dimensional anions. At least that we are aware of. Maybe there's, like, we did an exhaustive literature review and we couldn't find that being used. We presented this idea to some conferences last year, and everybody was very surprised to see creation operators in anions.
Oh, okay. Like experts on this sort of stuff, you mean?
Yes. Yeah.
I see. So potentially they could be useful in condensed matter physics for people who study.
Yes, hopefully, yes. This is one direction where, especially my collaborator, she's very excited about. Because, so for example, for running some computational models, like tensor networks, having creation operators really eases your calculation. And also, we can propose different modified Hamiltonians, such as the Haber model, directly to anions by just replacing the creation operators that you have for bosons, and models like that with Hopping terms, and study the spectra, all of this. So we're very excited about that.
Good. Okay, I have a question that's a bit broader, which is on your, on this slide that you're showing here, mm-hmm. you talked about the finding the free operations, which makes me think that it's, okay, let's study this, say, entanglement among anions as a resource theory.
Yeah.
And from my perspective, resource theory, like construct the theory, is a framework that to my mind is very much what I would call just a resource theory framework. Yeah. But you seem to describe them not in the same bullet point. So do you see a distinction between constructor theory and frameworks for resource theories?
No, precisely my one of the goals is like to unify them, like all work that you did with Bob on resource theory gives a very nice mathematical framework, and I see constructor theory like that. But my concern is precisely on this symmetric condition, on the symmetric monoidal category, because constructor theory it's constructed a bit more broader, to the expense of having less mathematical rigor and less mathematical structure. That is why I focused on this problem in the beginning. But one of the goals of my postdoc would be to really give a resource theoretic account of constructor theory. And also I would like to say that in some philosophical aspects, constructor theory brings some different picture. As, for example, for me, what is really interesting about constructor theory is the definition of information. And I would like to put that in a resource or diagrammatic language. So then a classification of what under this definition of information theory could be done. I hope this makes sense.
Yep. Good. Okay. And then the last two things are more kind of just a suggestion. So
perfect.
It seems to me that the idea of pursuing the Deutsch-Hayden kind of way of achieving locality, but with, you know, algebras of operators that aren't necessarily observables. You could test that idea out on real quantum mechanics and thereby free yourself from having to deal with all the complications of anyons and all of that, that a real quantum mechanics, I think, is already a great test bed for a place where local tomography fails. And therefore, any kind of local algebra that will be able to achieve a kind of local explanation in the Deutsch-Hayden sense will not be an algebra of observables. So it might be useful for you to sort of pursue that project and then, I don't know, maybe reconsider the objections to Deutsch-Hayden from that perspective, just because you've kind of been able to bracket all the complications having to do with anyons and the fact that swapping two operations picks up phase and all that kind of business.
I completely agree. I didn't thought it, to be honest. Like, I was aware of the complications of real quantum mechanics, but because my insight was more on applied to fundamental theories or to theories that theoretical physicists want to describe reality. That was my initial goal, but it's a very good suggestion. I will definitely do that. Thank you very much.
And then the other suggestion was just what you were saying about how entanglement theory changes for pairs of anyons reminded me a bit about some work that was done a few years ago, and I did some of this work myself on kind of reevaluating entanglement theory in the presence of local superselection rules. And not everything you were talking about would necessarily fit, because, you know, your notion of the asymmetry between the parts, I'm not sure that has a counterpart, but the kind of things that, you know, so this is work from, mid 2000s. We were interested in things like, if I impose a local superselection rule on number, for instance, so like say I have modes of a bosonic field and I say, I can't prepare superpositions of different numbers. Mm-hmm. Well, I can still prepare entangled states like 0, 1, plus 1, 0. So here, the 0 and 1 refer to, you know, vacuum and 1 excitation. That entangled state, however, I can't do anything useful with it. Whereas an entangled state where I have 2 modes on Alice's side and 2 modes on Bob's side, and I prepare things like 0, 1 for Alice, tensor 0, 1 for Bob, plus 1, 0 for Alice, tensor 1, 0 for Bob, that also obeys the super selection rule, right? Everything is...
Yep.
1, you know, 2 excitations, 1 excitation for Bob and Alice. But now I can use that entanglement. That's actually useful entanglement. And so if you sort of look at entanglement theory from the perspective of this local superselection rule, what you find is you have things like bound entanglement, like 0, 1, plus 1, 0 is something I need entanglement to create, but I can't get anything useful out of it. I can't teleport, I can't do anything. So you can sort of define things in a way where you have bound entanglement. You can unlock entanglement that's bound by providing another state. And in particular, the von Neumann entropy of the reduced density operator certainly doesn't quantify the entanglement. Like 0, 1, plus 1, 0 does not tell me how much useful entanglement I have because I have no useful entanglement there. So anyways, we wrote a paper about kind of analogies between the theory of mixed state entanglement and the theory of entanglement under local superselection rules. And so there's a lot of stuff that happens for pure states under local superselection rules that you would only see for mixed states in the usual scenario. And anyway, so it seemed to me that maybe some of the phenomena you're seeing are kind of like that. You have it as a sort of selection rule.
Yes, I was aware of this work, and I saw it when using the fermionic, when doing the fermionic information theory aspect of it, where you also have parity superselection rule, which is very similar to the number superselection rule, and all of this behavior where you have that mixed uncorrelated states are bigger than product states, you have all of this behavior that you have entanglement that it's not useful. But here, I think onions are quite distinct in this sense of the asymmetry between marginals, because this is something that really struck me as very different to previous work that was done. But I agree that all this previous work was very good, and I hope to read it more carefully and more thoroughly to find some very nice resources that we can apply here to quantify all of these aspects that you were mentioning.
You might want to test that hypothesis. Like, is it true that this asymmetry you describe is unique to anions? Maybe you can prove that. Because it's one thing to say, well, I've looked at the literature and about this sort of local superselection rules, and I didn't find anything like asymmetry. But that's a far cry from a proof that it doesn't arise. Maybe you just haven't, you know, found the right way of thinking about it. Maybe it does exist there under just these more conventional kinds of local superselection rules. You might want to try. And then if you can't succeed, then, you know, maybe you can really prove that it's only for anions, or maybe you can show it's a broader class of things. It happens in more than just anions. But yeah, it'd be useful to try to settle that question.
Yeah, that is a very nice suggestion. And I expect that it would happen to other systems that are not anions, because anions in the end are very concrete, but that you could constrain somehow on the type of constraint that you have on your system, then you would be able to say, depending on which type of constraint, you would be able to have this asymmetry or not this asymmetry. So this is what I would expect, and it's a very nice suggestion that to prove it rigorously.
Okay, and in the chat, I'll put the reference to one of the papers on this mixed state entanglement stuff in case you haven't seen it.
Perfect, thank you.
I think Lucien has a question for you now. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thanks. So very interesting. So just so I'm interested in this the penultimate point you make there, revisit reconstructions where local tomography is emphasized.
Yep.
So you're getting this breakdown of local tomography, and that's something Bill Wooters and I wrote a paper where we talked about a whole range of different types of tomography properties, like bi-local tomography and so on. And Dariano and Perinotti and so on in that paper that you cited at the beginning, they said that the fermionic case was bi-local tomography. Are you aware, like in the anionic case, can you say more about what happens with tomography?
Not exactly. No, like I haven't studied concretely. I was not aware of this classification that you made. I thought that some aspects of the work that I presented that I was aware of your work concretely would be more on the composition principle, and trying to see if the composition principle is satisfied in this anionic case. I would expect so. However, I would like to really interpret within your framework of the composition principle, this composition that we have, like these fusion channels. I don't know if this is the way I should be thinking about it, or if there's a different way to think about it. But in terms of the bilocal tomography, I would really love to read this paper and really analyze this anionic case if indeed anions are bilocal tomographic or not.
Okay, well then maybe you can look at the paper and see what you think. So then I had a related question. So when I read this paper on reconstructing quantum theory in 2001, and there was the assumption of local tomography. And in that paper, I expressed it as the assumption that A, which is the number of real parameters you need or number of properties required to specify a system. So you have the property that K for a composite system, so KAB, is equal to Ka times Kb. And then there's a sort of sister assumption, sister axiom, which is that n is the maximum number of states that can be distinguished, is equal to Na times Nb. And And you can sort of contrive odd looking situations where this second assumption is violated, where NAB is not equal to NA times NB. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if anions an example where this is actually violated or not. I was trying to understand from what you said whether you have this property.
I think yes.
You think, it is violated or yes, it's not?
It is violated. The second assumption, it is violated. The first assumption, it depends on the nature of the case. So if you interpret case in this as observables, as physical observables, then I think it's also violated. However, if you promote this case precisely to just allow them to be creation operators, so just operators, not observables, then the case, the first assumption, it's then satisfied.
Okay. So you're saying if you have two, so in terms of the second thing, the N equals NA times NP, you have two systems and they each have a certain number of distinguishable states.
Yes,
but when you bring the two systems together, then they have more, I assume?
Yeah, you have more, yeah.
More.
Exactly. Precisely in this Fibonacci anion case, in a single system, you have the distinguishable states are the type of particle. So basically, you will have two types of particles. So individually, this will have two types, this will have two types. However, when you bring them together, you will actually have five because you have two ways of combining these tau particles. So for one of the configurations, you would actually then have two possible combinations of the two. And these correspond in the theory to orthogonal states. Therefore, they are completely distinguishable between each other.
Oh, that's very interesting. I contrived an example where each system by itself only had so the example I contrived was where you had two boxes which would die, each was a die. Mm-hmm. So that they'd be labeled 1 to 6, they have six. When you brought them together, they unlocked each other and revealed some extra way that was hidden inside one of the boxes. So you can imagine you can contrive systems, but what you're discussing is a very natural situation that brings them. Okay. I find that very interesting. And I think I have more question, but now I don't remember. I'll leave it there.
Perfect. Okay. Thank you for the questions and the suggestion to study the bilocal tomography.
Are there further questions? In which case, thank you so much, Ms. Stu. This was very thorough and incredible to see that you've added so much to the field.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yep.
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Cross paths soon.
Yeah. Hope to see you soon in some conference or around. And thanks for the very nice questions, all the nice suggestions. And I hope it wasn't too long. And that at least was a bit in. Thank you very much.